Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Suicide bombers targeted a town in northeast Nigeria Wednesday, killing at least 15 people. Nigeria's Emergency Management Agency says three bombers set off explosives in the town of Damotoro in Yobe State. Witnesses say one of the early morning attacks was near a mosque filled with people at prayer, and another struck a housing development. At least a dozen people were taken to the hospital for injuries. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the attacks. The United States will not cooperate militarily with Russia and Syria because its strategy is tragically flawed, but is prepared to carry out basic technical discussions on pilot safety. That's according to U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter Wednesday. He spoke to journalists during a news conference with his Italian counterpart, Roberta Pinotti, that the Russian strategy in Syria is wrong.
Russia has the wrong strategy. They continue to hit targets that are not ISIL. We believe this is a fundamental mistake. Despite what the Russians say, we have not agreed to cooperate with Russia so long as they continue to pursue a mistaken strategy and hit these targets.
Secretary Carter's comments come as Russia said Wednesday that it used four warships in the Caspian Sea to launch rockets at Islamic State targets in Syria. The country's defense minister told Russian President Vladimir Putin that the vessels fired 26 cruise missiles at 11 IS targets, which he said were destroyed without causing any civilian casualties. The results of the strike confirmed the high effectiveness of the missiles at great distances, nearly 1,500 kilometers, according to the defense minister. VOA News. A spokesman for the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo said human rights groups concerned about abuses in the DRC should cooperate with the government by providing proof of alleged violations so that the government may investigate such claims. Human Rights Watch released a report Tuesday that accused the top security and ruling party officials in the DRC of hiring thugs to attack peaceful demonstrators last month, calling on President Joseph Kabila not to seek another term when his mandate ends in December. The country's information minister said the allegations are not credible because Human Rights Watch has yet to provide a single name to support its claim. Europe reacted too slowly to the turmoil on its borders that produced a huge wave of refugees. That assessment comes from French President François Hollande in a joint speech to the European Parliament with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. I acknowledge that Europe was slow in understanding the tragedy in the Middle East or Africa, but could not have consequences for Europe itself, Hollande said, alongside the German chancellor. The comments by both the German and French leader comes as the European Union has started a new operation in the southern Mediterranean Sea to intercept human trafficking boats trying to enter the bloc illegally. The medical charity Doctors Without Borders is calling for an international humanitarian fact-finding commission to investigate the U.S. airstrike on its hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, in which at least 22 patients and staff were killed. Lisa Schlein reports.
Joanne Liu, the international president of Doctors Without Borders, says it is time to activate this fact-finding tool.
The facts and circumstances of this attack must be investigated independently and impartially.
She says letters were sent Tuesday to the 76 signatory countries of the commission to sponsor an inquiry. She says the assent of only one country is needed, and United States and Afghan governments must give their consent to trigger the probe. Liu says the commission's role is only to establish and clarify facts. She says it is not a legal body and cannot determine whether a war crime has been committed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Palestinian woman stabbed an Israeli man who then shot and wounded her in Jerusalem's Old City. It comes after Israel lifted some of the tight security measures imposed after a series of Palestinian attacks. A suspected Palestinian militant later stabbed an Israeli soldier in the southern Israeli town of Kiryat Gat before being pursued by security forces and shot dead, according to police. The Wednesday attacks are the latest violent incidents that are escalating Israeli-Palestinian tensions. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wahib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Certainly the crisis after World War II was much larger, and actually I think it's important to keep that in mind in order to put what's going on now in perspective.
That's University of Michigan Associate Professor Pamela Bollinger comparing Europe's migrant and refugee crisis to World War II. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the World Bank says economic growth in Africa has fallen largely because of falling global commodity prices. And 15 Nigerians died in a mosque in the city of Damaturo in Yobe State this morning when two women carrying explosives under their garments detonated their bombs.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the general in charge of the failed coup in Burkina Faso last month has been formally charged, along with one other top official accused of supporting the overthrow of Burkina Faso's government. General Gilbert Diendere and Djibril Bassolé, a former foreign minister, were charged yesterday with attacking state security. During the failed coup, Diendere's forces in the elite presidential guard detained the interim president, prime minister, and several cabinet members. The guard was unhappy the interim government barred supporters of former President Blaise Compaoré from running in upcoming elections. Compaoré was ousted in a popular uprising in October of last year as he tried to extend his 27 years in office. General Diendere held power for nearly a week, but was forced to step down under pressure from the army, demonstrators, and the West African bloc ECOWAS. Diendere gave himself up last week following negotiations with officials in the capital, Ouagadougou. Bassolé, who served as foreign minister under Compaoré, has denied any connection with the coup. Both men remain in custody. Burkina Faso was planning to hold presidential and parliamentary elections on October 11th. It remains unclear when that vote will take place.
The World Bank says economic growth in Africa will fall to a low not seen since 2009, a drop largely caused by falling global commodity prices. VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg looks at the report and what it means.
The famous Africa Rising narrative appears to have hit a road bump, with the World Bank predicting in a new report that economic growth on the continent will slow to 3.7% this year. The bank's vice president for Africa, Makhtar Diop, says the main culprit is obvious. Falling global commodity prices have a huge impact on African economies, many of which rely on exporting raw materials.
Today's external environment is changing. We have a slowdown of major economies in Africa, in the world, but also we have commodity prices we have been falling dramatically. That is raising a certain number of challenges for African countries.
He also noted other factors, like China's economic slowdown, the tightening of global financial conditions, and African nations' chronic problems with supplying enough electricity. But Martin Davis, Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa at Deloitte Frontier Advisory, says the numbers are skewed by the large resource-rich economies like Nigeria, Angola, and South Africa. East African nations, which don't have the benefit of massive deposits of oil, gas, or minerals, are actually doing pretty well. The bank acknowledges that in its report, pointing out that countries not known as resource giants, like Ethiopia, Ivory Coast, Mozambique, Rwanda, and Tanzania, are expected to see about 7% growth in the coming year. Still, Davis notes, every nation should implement policies that promote stable long-term growth. One way to do that, he says, is to privatize moribund state industries, a pill that might be politically difficult to swallow.
This needs to be a wake-up call. Countries in our region, amongst many other regions, also think Latin America particularly, have become drunk on overpriced commodities-driven growth. Now we need to start to move away from that, be less complacent.
Economists have predicted that low oil prices will persist for some time, which means this slump could be a blessing in disguise, as African nations are forced to figure out how to escape the old narrative of being the world's resource providers and truly rise on their own. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The European Union has launched a naval campaign called Operation Sophia to board and seize vessels in the Mediterranean that carry migrants to Europe. Italy's aircraft carrier Cavour has led the monitoring of migrant trafficking in the Mediterranean since June, with rotating naval support from Germany and Britain. Britain's HMS Richmond has now joined the European Union naval force in its effort to stop the human trafficking. However, an official of the UN International Office for Migration, IOM, says the ocean-going enforcement will fail unless the EU also takes on criminal gangs in Europe that are involved in arms and drug smuggling, as well as human trafficking. IOM European Regional Director Eugenio Ambrosi says the transitional criminal rings of traffickers are the same as those involved in weapons and drugs.
More than 130,000 migrants have sailed from North Africa to Europe so far this year. An estimated 2,700 of those are believed to have drowned. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande are expected to appear before the European Parliament today to discuss the migrant crisis. In Budapest, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Hungarian Parliament says they have joined with Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia to control the flow of migrants at the EU's external borders. The chairman says it's a model for all EU countries. However, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Saeed Raad al-Hussein cautioned the EU Justice and Home Affairs Council yesterday that measures to manage the massive migrant flows do not become detention centers in disguise.
Europe's refugee crisis has been described by many as the largest there since World War II. But is that an accurate comparison? Pamela Bollinger is a University of Michigan Associate Professor of History and an expert on refugees, human rights, and displacement. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCampua about the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees to Europe and how it compares to the Second World War.
I think that for Europe, in terms of the magnitude, it certainly is the largest refugee crisis since World War II, but Europe has also experienced, as we know, a number of significant refugee crises since World War II, particularly the Hungarian refugee crisis and the refugee flows produced by the wars in Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Probably in terms of numbers, this is the largest, but it depends on how you want to reckon magnitude. This perhaps is impacting the most countries within Europe at the same moment, also makes it seem like a greater emergency. But certainly the crisis after World War II was much larger, and actually I think it's important to keep that in mind in order to put what's going on now in perspective.
It's also, I guess, important to keep in mind that Europe was a shambles after World War II, so conditions were a lot different, no?
Right, of course. And that's the thing is, although Europe is still struggling with the effects of the Great Recession at the moment, as you say, after 1945, so much of continental Europe was actually in ruins. And some people estimate that on Victory Europe Day, there were as many as 11 million displaced persons in Europe. So that gives some pause to think about when people say that Europe is at its limits and can't absorb anymore. Actually, the magnitude of the crisis was so much higher in 1945, and Europe was in very devastated conditions to deal with the refugee problem then.
I also know that you look into the human rights aspects of refugee crises, and we're hearing a number of countries opposing the required quotas for the resettlement of refugees. Hungary seems to be leading the way. What does this tell you about this ongoing crisis?
Well, it reminds us that, unfortunately, many declarations and conventions on human rights are ultimately non-binding. They rely upon good faith or pressure of certain kinds, but they're very difficult to enforce at the international level when countries who have signed on to those agreements decide that they don't want to honor them in practice. But I think there is a groundswell, obviously, around the understanding and notion of human rights. And I think the flip side of the negative responses of a country like Hungary, the official level, are the grassroots efforts that many Europeans have undertaken to assist refugees. I think here we see many Europeans have a very deep commitment to the idea of human rights and see it as central to the identity of the European Union and to the post-1945 Europe. And so I think it's important to remember that there are many in Europe who really are working in the name of the human rights of these displaced persons who are coming into Europe.
Let me ask you about the impact of the refugee flows. First, let me ask you about the negative effects of the inflow. What do you see happening?
Unfortunately, I haven't been in Europe myself since June, but certainly the impacts in the first instance, you have an acute humanitarian crisis, right? There's a kind of organizational, logistical problem that is created. How do we care for these people? How do we provide them with immediate services, food, water, housing, and so on? Then there's the larger question of settling these refugees. How do you integrate them into economic and cultural systems, social systems that are very different from the ones in which they came? And then even when there's goodwill, then the political question, you know, so we're seeing this now with the criticism of Merkel. Merkel has put Germany at the forefront of the European countries willing to take refugees, but of course she faces political opposition at home because, as usually happens, domestic constituencies say, well, we have our own problems. Why are we dedicating these resources to others?
Could the refugees actually help Europe?
Oh, I think so. One can think of them as a resource. They need workers of particular kinds. And one of the things that I've been struck by in the coverage of this crisis, we see so many not only articulate refugees who've been interviewed, but refugees who are extremely fluent in English and other European languages. Many of them have linguistic resources that already will facilitate at least their integration.
That's University of Michigan Associate Professor Pamela Ballinger. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The International Organization for Migration says it is the target of disinformation campaign in war-torn Central African Republic. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration says a defamation campaign in Central African Republic has been going on since its headquarters in the capital, Bangui, was attacked more than 1 week ago. It says the IOM office was extensively ransacked and aid intended for thousands of people sheltered in displacement camps was stolen. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says while the looting was taking place, reports began surfacing in the international and social media claiming IOM was harboring weapons. He says these media reports also accused IOM of taking sides in the sectarian violence.
We want to point out that there were never any weapons or any offensive weapons in our headquarters in Bangui, but there were approximately 35 self-protection kits. I believe those are Kevlar armored vests and helmets that a lot of international aid agencies keep on hand. 35 have gone missing. We presume they're with the looters.
The September 27th attack on IOM headquarters followed the murder of a young Muslim man in Bangui the previous day. That killing triggered a resurgence of widespread ethnic and religious fighting in Central African Republic. Dozens of people were left dead and scores injured. Millman tells VOA he does not know who is behind the disinformation campaign, but that it has a lot to do with what he calls religious competition.
The violence started with the rumor of a pedicab driver who was murdered, and that triggered a rampage against Christian neighborhoods. I can only speculate that whoever is involved in that violence sees their opposite religious group as in our pocket.
Milman says these false rumors must be squashed immediately before they gain a kind of legitimacy. He says they are putting IOM staff in the country in danger. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, 15 Nigerians died in a mosque in the city of Damotoro in Yobe State this morning when two women carrying explosives under their garments detonated their bombs. Only hours before the mosque bombing, about 100 Boko Haram fighters launched an attack on a rural army camp near the village of Goniri. A military spokesman said the insurgents were repulsed, but seven troops died and nine were injured. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says the six-year Islamist insurgency in northeastern Nigeria has created the fastest-growing displacement crisis in Africa. It estimates that 2.5 million people have fled their homes in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. And it says government forces are starting to have an effect, but the humanitarian response is starved of funds and is straining at the seams.
African air traffic safety and security experts are calling for more investment to guarantee safe air travel on the continent. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Ghanaian-born Africa aviation expert Ose Bonsu says Africa accounts for barely 5% of global air traffic, but reported 20% of accidents and fatalities in 2014.
We need a coordinated effort to be able to build rescue centers where we can pick as soon as it happens, we call and then they move. Now what is happening individually is that most countries are using their air force as a coordinated center. The aircraft dropped, if it is in the ocean, the people they contact is their air force. They move them to the spot just to locate. And after locating, how do you rescue? That is the challenge.
Bonsu says more training is needed on air traffic management as the number of flights continue to multiply. Air navigation safety expert Sidi Koni says scores of small air companies operate in sub-Saharan Africa without respecting international norms. Losing track of planes is an issue.
Nous nous retrouvons pour voir si il y a des points d'amélioration.
He says traffic coordination and communication need to improve. Connie says they have to make sure planes do not find themselves on the same routes as they move through the region. Air traffic controllers in Africa say they lack personnel and proper communication equipment. Safety experts gathered in Cameroon this week said air traffic personnel in some countries must rely on mobile phone networks. Power outages at airports and animals trespassing on runways are also among the top frustrations and dangers, they said. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
For decades, efforts by governments, NGOs, and agriculture scientists to end hunger and malnutrition have focused on productivity, that is, the quantity of food produced. Well, today, those same stakeholders are becoming just as interested in the vitamins and minerals that food contains or the nutritional quality of the food. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the economist Howard Buis, director of Harvest Plus. It's a Washington, D.C. nonprofit group that breeds more nutritious plants and shares these foods with Africa and the world.
Our target is to improve mineral and vitamin intakes. And what distinguishes us is that we're breeding plants to put more minerals and vitamins in the food staples that the poor eat day in and day out.
You're actually creating new kinds of plants, right?
Yes. The way I express it is that we're getting the plants to do the work. There are a couple of advantages using the plant breeding strategy. The first is that we start with the smallholder farmers who are growing the crops that they eat. And when you have the fortified foods that are made in the factories, they often don't reach the rural areas. The second is that it's cost effective. By getting the plants to do the work, once they're in the food system, you don't have recurrent costs. So essentially the vitamin A and the iron and the zinc is coming free to the households.
Now, is this the same as so-called genetically modified crops? I mean, that people are kind of concerned about in the United States, maybe they can afford to be.
It's not. We're using conventional plant breeding. We're just crossing high-yielding varieties with the high-nutrient varieties and getting high-yielding, high-nutrient varieties so that we're not using the GMO technology at all.
What is your approach in terms of getting traditional farms to use this? Are there any challenges in terms of getting people on board to actually plant these plants?
Well, we really have two messages for the farmers. The first is that our crops are just as high-yielding and just as productive, so you're not sacrificing profits from the crops. They can also be sold in the market. Farmers are always looking for that. But then you get the added value of the extra vitamins and minerals in the crops.
Let me see if I understand what Harvest Plus does more carefully. Is it that you develop these things or you just sort of advocate for them? I mean, what is your involvement in it? A lot of people obviously are in the business of trying to make food more nutritious.
Well, the plant breeding process takes a while to develop the crops. To do the crossing to get the high yields and the high minerals and vitamins in the crops is an 8 to 10 year process to develop them. Then once they're approved for release in the countries, now we're involved in the job of getting them out to farmers and scaling up. We have the varieties now released in 28 different countries around the world. Now that we're getting the crops out to farmers, we're partnering with NGOs to take our crops and incorporating them in their programs, in the programs of the NGOs, in reaching out to farmers in developing countries. What we're doing now is quite a bit different than when Harvest Plus got started in 2003. So in the beginning, we had to prove that we could develop these crops in high-yielding backgrounds. There was some doubt about that. And we released our first varieties in 2012 in Africa. We also had to do nutrition studies. We had to prove that when vitamin A deficient, iron deficient, zinc deficient people ate our crops, that we could improve their mineral and vitamin status. And now we've done those nutrition studies and we've convinced the nutrition community that we can make a significant contribution to reducing mineral and vitamin deficiencies. Now in the last 2 or 3 years, now that the crops are released, our focus is on extension to farmers and convincing consumers to eat these crops. So we're really into delivery and scaling up now. The governments are really quite excited. Initially, we chose target countries where we introduced a single crop. And in every case, the governments have said, why aren't you bringing all your crops to our country? Why are you just bringing a single crop? It's really gratifying to see all this time and effort that's gone into this starting to have some real impact.
That was Howard Buis, director of Harvest Plus, an international program of agricultural scientists and nutrition and food policy experts based in Washington, D.C. Buis spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Riek Machar, South Sudan's opposition leader and former vice president, will sit down with host Shaka Sali. We'll discuss the recent peace accord and examine the country's uncertain future as the November deadline for the agreement draws near. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The European Union has launched a naval campaign called Operation Sophia to board and seize vessels in the Mediterranean that carry migrants to Europe. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa, and in our feature segment, the law that changed the face of America, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Skuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
And I understand you are kicking off today with African football.
Kim, Africa's qualifying campaign for the 2018 World Cup football tournament in Russia officially kicked off Wednesday. Let's take a look at the results. Remember, VOA World Cup fans, these are first leg matches. The second leg matches are scheduled for next week, with the winners on aggregate advancing to the second round. In Dar es Salaam Wednesday, the host Taifa Stars of Tanzania topped the Flames of Malawi 2-0. The Swallows of Burundi scored a 1-0 road victory over Seychelles. In Moroni, the capital of the Comoros Islands, Comoros and Lesotho played to a scoreless draw. It marks the first ever point for the Comoros Islands in World Cup qualifying. They lost their four previous World Cup qualifying matches. In Juba, heavy rains on Wednesday washed out the World Cup qualifier between South Sudan and visiting Mauritania. The match was abandoned after only 10 minutes, with the score tied at 1-1. World Football's governing body FIFA says the game will resume on Thursday at 11 a.m. local time in Juba from the point where the match was stopped. South Sudan, Africa's newest country, became a FIFA member in 2012, and this is its first ever World Cup qualifying match. And on that note, let's give a sunny side of sports shout-out for Dominic Aboui-Pitino, who scored South Sudan's first World Cup qualifying goal. Dominic equalized in the fifth minute after Mauritania's Boubacar Baghili opened the scoring in the third minute. In one other African World Cup qualifying result from Wednesday, the Harambee Stars of Kenya scored a 5-2 road victory over Mauritius. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a nice photo of former world heavyweight boxing champions Larry Holmes and George Foreman with their arms around each other. Holmes and Foreman both fought Muhammad Ali, and they recently appeared at a ceremony in Ali's hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, where Sports Illustrated magazine renamed its Legacy Award in honor of the 73-year-old Ali. Larry Holmes scored a 10th-round TKO over Muhammad Ali in 1980. It was Ali's second-to-last fight. He retired the following year after a loss to Trevor Burbick in the Bahamas. Holmes says Muhammad Ali is a worthy recipient of the Sports Illustrated honor.
Well, you know what? I've known him a long time, and I think it's deserving. I think anybody who went through the things that he went through in the game of boxing deserved it. You know, a lot of times people go through it and they forget all about it until the end. At least he has the opportunity to see the people and to see the ones who really cared about him.
Larry Holmes and more than a few others still really care about Muhammad Ali, who has suffered from Parkinson's disease for more than 30 years. Ali attended the event in his honor in Louisville, but he hasn't spoken in public in years because of the Parkinson's. Now let's go to New York City, where the Major League Baseball playoffs got underway Tuesday night at Yankee Stadium. A crowd of 50,113, the largest at the stadium this year, watched the New York Yankees lose to the Houston Astros 3-0 in an American League wildcard game. With the victory, the Astros move on to play the Kansas City Royals in a division playoff series. One of baseball's best pitchers, Houston's Dallas Keuchel, shut out the Yankees over six innings to get the win. The 27-year-old Keuchel, who also sports one of baseball's best beards, says growing up, he also pitched in big games in Little League. In fact, Keuchel and more than a few other Major League players got their start playing Little League baseball. VOA's Adam Phillips attended a Little League game here in Washington, and he has this feature for us.
The sun shone warm on the Marlins and the Yankees, two Little League teams of eight-year-olds, as they stood on the new springtime grass before their baseball game and sang their sport's unofficial theme song. The game gets underway with the Marlins playing offense, hoping to score. While they wait their turn to bat, a few players explain what they like about baseball.
My favorite thing about the game is that you get to bat and you can go to World Series and get trophies.
I like to play it because there's like strategy in it, and I like strategy games.
What would you tell a kid far away about baseball?
Well, you play with a bat and gloves and a ball. Well, you have to score runs. You've got to see who can get the most runs.
When you get to know the rules, it's really fun.
What's the most fun about it?
Probably either when you're up at bat or when you just...
What just happened?
Peter, he's on my team, he just hit the ball and someone caught it. When you catch a ball, then the batter's out. So all those people going, oh man, were our team members.
So it's a kind of an emotional game, huh?
Yeah. When the ball comes, you miss it, you're sad.
Or if you catch it, you're joyful and you're happy and wonderful.
Happy and wonderful is in fact just how a brother and sister pair on the opposing team felt after they caught that ball.
And that is what I call pride. You don't care if you're losing by 11 points. You're just wonderful. You feel great.
Before long, fortunes have been reversed. Three Marlins have managed to hit the ball and are on base when...
What just happened?
Ben just got a home run. Yeah. Good job, Ben.
So tell me, Ben, how do you feel right now? What do you do?
I did a grand slam. That means that you make 4 points.
So that was a really good hit, huh?
Yeah.
One of the boys, Ben, batted home, gulped some water, and recounts his triumph.
I was at third base, and then they said, go, go, go. So I ran home, and I didn't get out.
You feel proud?
Yes.
So does Dan Gross, the Marlins team coach and a Little League parent.
It looks pretty remarkable. I guess, you know, all this practicing and playing is paying off because the kids are batting magnificently now. And at the beginning of the season, it wasn't so good. But as always happens every season, not only do they get the rust out, but they grow and they improve. And it's very gratifying.
The Yankees are now losing to the Marlins by several points.
You were standing straight up. You weren't down and ready. Be down and ready. Watch the ball from the pitcher's hands.
Eric Moore coaches both the Yankees, where his 8-year-old son is at work in the shortstop position, and the Braves, which his 5-year-old plays for.
It's a great game to learn and enjoy and spend a life with. You don't have to be a super athlete. It's a skill game. So if you learn the skills, catching, throwing, hitting, and running. You can compete with the best of them. And that's why I like it. The underdog has a chance, always.
Is that the American aspect?
That is the American aspect. America's all about the underdog. I mean, as long as they're working hard and they're learning as much as they can, there's nothing that can stop them.
Soon, the Yankees get their chance to bat and manage to score several runs themselves. Karen Baldy is a parent.
You try and stay detached, but the other day, my daughter came up. The bases were loaded, and she whacked that ball really hard, and we watched it, and it was a legitimate good hard hit, and it was marvelous. It was thrilling. It was embarrassingly wonderful to experience your child doing something like that. I would have cheered that hard for anyone on the team. I just would have, but it was my girl, and it was just great.
Ready, guys?
2, 4, 6, 8. We appreciate Yankees!
An hour and a half after it began, the Yankee-Marlins game is over, and the Marlins have won.
Good game, guys. Good play. What a hit, guys.
Good game.
While the two teams congratulate each other in a little league ritual of good sportsmanship, one Yankee cheers himself up with a memory from the previous Saturday.
And I hit the ball through the playground. I hit it in the air into the outfield, and then it went rolling in the playground, and I went around the bases as hard as I can, and I got a triple. It was like my first real important play of my life, and I really want to be in the big league, so I think it will be a good inspiration on me.
At the Yankee Marlins Little League game in Cleveland Park in Washington, D.C., this is Adam Phillips reporting.
Won't take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Find me some peanuts, I'll buy you crackers. As long as you count my outs when I come up to bat. Oh, now it's root, 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 root. Win or lose, lose or win, we're all the same. Oh, won't you please take me out to the old.
Take me out to the ball game. And thanks to VOA's Adam Phillips for that feature. Turning to athletics, Jamaica's Olympic and World Sprint champion Shelly Ann Fraser Price visited Namibia this week. If you check out Shelly Ann's Facebook page, you'll see some very nice photos from her visit, which included a stop at a Namibian sports facility, as well as a trip to Etosha National Park in northwestern Namibia, where she saw some African wildlife. The 28-year-old Jamaican speedster, nicknamed Pocket Rocket because of her small size but explosive starts, is a two-time Olympic champion at 100 meters. And this year in Beijing, Shelly Ann became the first female sprinter to be crowned world champion at 100 meters three times. Shelly Ann Fraser Price, running for glory in Namibia. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, UN officials in South Sudan preparing to demine parts of the embattled South Sudan as the rainy season ends. And next, the law that changed the face of America, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. But first, some music. Here is Zahara from South Africa with Umtawalo.
Yeah.
Chaka Chaka from South Africa with Ubambe.
Well, UN officials in South Sudan say they're preparing to demine parts of the embattled country as the rainy season ends. One official says the country was already awash in unexploded ordnance from the decades of war with Khartoum before the latest conflict. Philip Thon Aliyu has more from Juba.
Tim Lanna, the head of the United Nations Mine Action Service, or UNMAS, in South Sudan, says between July 2014 and June 2015, UNMAS cleared nearly 20 million square meters of land before handing it back to the communities.
So in real terms, that means that we are providing protection of civilians by clearing those hazardous areas. By clearing the minefields, we're making way for safe ground for agriculture, for kids to play in the fields, and for people to go back to their normal lives.
Letna says UNMAS stopped demining activities when the conflict erupted in late 2013. Letna says they were able to clear areas where landmines were planted by the warring parties. Now, he says, his agency wants to focus on removing all ordnance planted during the last 20 months of conflict.
Since December 2013, there is evidence of mines being laid. We are not able to identify who has laid those mines. There have been a couple of incidents over the last 6 months on a road up in Bentui. We are unable to directly attribute at the moment. We hope to be able to give a clearer position when we're able to do so.
Lenna says UNMAS is working in Bor, Marakal, Juba, Bentui and Wau at protection of civilian sites as well as supporting UNMIS and humanitarian partners to operate safely. He says they also need to reach former combat zones in Alpha Nile, Unity and Jonglei states where some of the worst fighting occurred.
We are undertaking clearance in those areas where we can gain access and where there is a problem of contamination. So a lot of the resources are allocated to the equatorias where we can access. We do undertake clearance further north, but access is much more difficult there.
Ladna says they have discovered more areas in central and eastern Equatorial states that were mined during the 1983 through 2005 war between then Southern Sudanese rebels and Khartoum. He urged all individuals to report any suspected objects. Lenna says he hopes the warring parties to the recent conflict will respect and implement the peace agreement they signed so UNMAS personnel have a chance to continue their demining activities across the country. For VOA News, I am Philip Thon Aliyu in Juba.
Recent Pew research indicates nearly 60 million immigrants have come to the United States since 1965. The portion of America's population that is foreign-born rivals that of the immigration waves from Europe a century ago. Much of the influx was made possible by a law that was passed 50 years ago. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Margaret Orchowski. She's a congressional reporter specializing in immigration and author of the Law That Changed the Face of America, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965.
The Immigration and Nationality Act totally changed immigration selection in the United States, and it replaced a law of 1924 called the National Origins Quota Act, which specified in writing a preference for Northern Europeans. There was no limit to the number of Northern Europeans who could come in on permanent immigration visas. And there was no limit on Mexicans either. They were considered from the Southwest. But everyone else, Africans, Asians, Latinos, Eastern Europeans, and also Southern Italians, those groups were severely limited. Some of them, they only could have maybe 50 visas a year.
What was the reason for that law?
Very complicated, but there was a huge scare of foreign invasion. Mainly at those days, people were scared of communism. Now you can say it's ISIS. And we had just finished World War I. Everybody was scared there was going to be another war, and they didn't want to get involved. So all of these things made a mood in the country to say, we have to protect our borders. We have to have fewer immigrants. So we're going to restrict immigrants just to nationalities that mainly make up our heritage. and limit everything else. So in 1965, we have totally different circumstances. We have a post-war euphoria. America is in an economic boom, and there is a tremendous guilt about World War II, the Holocaust, that did not allow Jews to come in because this law, the 1920 law, totally restricted Jews. And in 1964, the Civil Rights Act passed. And that specifically forbade discrimination in any way by the government on the basis of race, religion, creed, and national origin. But here we had an immigration law that was completely based on discrimination on national origin. So they had to get rid of it. The other thing they did was they got rid of a preference on immigration for work skills. The focus now became on family reunification. Those were two huge, tremendous changes.
I understand, though, that in order to get this thing passed through Congress, Senator Kennedy and Johnson, to some extent, and Manny Seller, the Brooklyn congressman, the Jewish congressman, promised Americans that this would not change the sort of cultural or demographic fabric of the United States. And that turned out not to be true.
That's right. Some people think now with hindsight, well, they were just lying, but they just didn't realize the Pandora's box that they were opening. In the 1960s, 90% of the immigrants were from Europe. Now, 10% of immigrants are from Europe. I'm from California, so the West Coast, the majority of minorities are Asian. But here on the East Coast, the number of African immigrants is very, very visible. And most of them are highly educated. You see them in all the think tanks, but you see them also in the schools and the colleges and driving taxis. I think a lot of people don't really understand that this 1965 bill changed so dramatically what we had before.
As far as the all the illegal immigrants and people overstaying and abusing the visas they've been granted, is their ability to do that traceable directly to the 1965 Act?
Oh, yeah. Many people said, well, I'll just come in on a temporary visa and eventually I'll get legalization. And as far as the diversity goes, I think most people think that's a very good thing. However, now we want high-tech workers. Well, the fact is that the majority of them are Asian, Indians, Chinese, Koreans. So what about the balance of national origins on that? Same with family unification. When now that we have technology like Skype, do you really need to have immigrants being in their extended families? You know, you could Skype them all day. It's not like you'll never see them again. It's very complicated, but I think we're headed more for a skill-based and not so much nationality-oriented, probably do away with family unification, because it really does take away a good proportion of the green cards.
Margaret Orchowski is the author of The Law That Changed the Face of America, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, which was signed into law by U.S. President Lyndon Johnson 50 years ago. She spoke with VOA reporter Adam Phillips in New York. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the dual explosions in the Yanya and Kuji areas of Abuja on October 2nd, and the suicide bombings and militant attacks in Maiduguri and Adamawa on October 1st. We extend our deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of those killed and injured. These tragic events are stark reminders that violent extremists will stop at nothing to inflict horrific and indiscriminate harm upon innocent civilians. In particular, Boko Haram's reign of terror and sheer brutality have left thousands dead and millions displaced. To assist those nations threatened by Boko Haram, President Barack Obama recently delegated authority to the Secretary of State to direct the drawdown of up to $45 million in defense articles and services, as well as military education and training, to support Benin, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria's efforts to defeat Boko Haram. This will enable the Secretary to authorize the provision of critical airlift support and other assistance, including to help the Lake Chad Basin countries move troops and equipment to the border region from which Boko Haram terrorists continue to launch brutal attacks on civilians. This assistance builds on training, equipment, and logistical support that the United States is providing using other authorities. The United States also continues to provide advisors and share information with our regional partners to enhance counter-Boko Haram operations, as well as victim support and counter-violent extremism programming. Since 2009, Boko Haram has killed more than 10,000 people, devastated communities, and left deep scars in the lives of those affected by its violence. Boko Haram's indiscriminate violence has created more than 2 million internally displaced persons and over 200,000 refugees throughout the Lake Chad Basin region. Defeating Boko Haram will require a holistic campaign that protects human rights, pairs progress on development and governance with security measures, and fills in behind military successes with civilian stabilization efforts. The United States stands with our partners in the region who are fighting to end Boko Haram's campaign of terror that threatens to rob an entire generation of the benefits of unfettered access to education, health care, and economic development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Riek Machar, South Sudan's opposition leader and former vice president, will sit down with host Shaka Sali. We'll discuss the recent peace accord and examine the country's uncertain future as the November deadline for the agreement draws near. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on Straight Talk Africa.